what is magical about Serpentine is the big sky.
Coastal marine ecosystems are diverse and productive. However, the climate emergency and human activities have massively had an impact on coastal habitat.
Amazonian sort of waterfalls coming off the tidal pool had smaller sheltered pools. It got a lot of attention.
And there's a lot of discussion about materials, particularly in terms of construction of housing and office blocks, and a lot of debate about using both stone and wood.
Yeah, I mean, you only have to go down to the Serpentine to see how big the movement is.
There is something quite exciting about swimming at the foot of a tower block.
And I just felt amazing for the rest of the day. It's a very natural high.
You're listening to Talking Landscape, a podcast which explores the big issues in placemaking, nature and the environment through conversations with leading landscape architects and practitioners. I'm your host, Paul Lincoln, editor of Landscape, the journal on which this podcast is based. In this episode, we will be looking at the landscape of swimming, and in particular at tidal pools and the benefits that they can bring to coastal ecosystems and communities. Joining me today is Chris Romer-Lee. Chris is the co-founder of architect studio Octopi, Thames Baths and Future Lidos Group, and he's also the author of the recently published Sea Pools, which came out in 2023. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Paul.
Chris, we're going to talk about community pools and we're going to talk about tidal pools. But I want to start off with the fact that one thing we have in common is we're both members of the Serpentine Swimming Club in Hyde Park in central London. And clearly, swimming is an important part of your life. Clearly, as an architect, you could have spent your time designing office blocks. Tell me about your particular engagement with swimming. Where did that start? Why is it so important to you?
It started a very long time ago, I guess. My parents always used to take me on watery holidays, as I said, you know, down to the coast or onto canal boats. So it wasn't really until I launched Thames Baths in 2013, which was an Architecture Foundation and Royal Academy open call for future ideas for the Thames, that I began to look back on the past of why I was so keen about swimming. Now, I'm very much from the Roger Deakin camp, and I swim around breaststroke looking at the birds and the trees as opposed to goggles and splashing water. So Thames Baths was purely about getting people back into the Thames, getting them re-engaging with London's largest public space.
Let's talk about the benefits of sea swimming in particular. And first of all, define a tidal pool.
Define a tidal pool, yes. Probably the best way of describing a tidal pool is a man-made pool, usually formed around a natural depression in a rock. So it is similar to a natural pool, not natural rock pool, but it usually has a man-made addition to it, in which case when the tide comes in and it floods the pool, as the tide falls away, you have a fresh held body of seawater kept there. And then, of course, the tide is changing twice a day, so you get fresh water twice a day.
So what makes them different from, say, an outdoor Lido that's very near to the sea?
So an outdoor Lido, another conversation, is usually fresh water. It can be, there are some seawater ones, but they're always pumped, especially if they're seawater pools, and they can be heated. So this, I think what grabs me about the tidal pools is that they are relying on the beauty of nature. They refresh the water through the tide, they're unheated, and they include a whole wealth of other ecosystems within them.
Thank you. Give us some examples of tidal pools around the world.
Okay, so the best ones are in Australia and South Africa, or when I say the best, they're the most spectacular to look at, the colour of the water, the sort of arrangement within the rocks. We're blessed with some absolute beauties in Scotland and Cornwall and a few in Kent. And the book sort of includes sort of 66 of some of the finest pools around the world. I have a OneDrive packed full of another 200 of these pools, so watch out for later editions.
Now, in your article, you talk about the history of tidal pools and their emergence in the late 18th century, when physicians began to recommend immersion in, and indeed consumption of, seawater as a cure for all ailments. What were these early tidal pools like?
They were particularly beautiful because there's one I particularly found called Lady Bassett's Pools at Portreath in Cornwall. And what was magical about those ones, which were formed in 1782, is that they were actually carved directly out of the rocks on the beach. And the estate's stonemason carved them at different levels up the beach so that Lady Bassett had access to tidal water as soon as it appeared, as the tide dropped away. So she got a series of fresh pools. These were probably about over sort of a oversized bath, so to speak. So they were cut square into the rock. Some had steps up into them and down into them. And then over the years, they've become sort of soft and fleshy as the waves have eroded them. But you can still go to them, use them. And it was her way, basically, of grabbing that moment of when sea swimming or seawater was seen as the cure-all for everything. And she wanted her own Brighton, her own Scarborough, right on her estate.
And is it about immersion in water only, or is it about swimming in water? Is the swimming important?
At that stage, it was more about the immersion and consumption of. But of course, people were beginning to swim in the sea. Us men were blessed with being able to go naked, whereas the women were fully dressed in their clothes. And usually there was a separation in the pools, so segregated swimming. And in fact, segregated swimming lasted all the way up until the 1940s in some of the Lidos as well. So men were arrested if they were seen to be creeping towards having a look at the women swimming and vice versa.
Obviously, it's not only people's health that we should be concerned about. The natural environment needs to be considered too. Coastal marine ecosystems are diverse and productive. However, the climate emergency and human activities like fishing, aquaculture and energy production have massively had an impact on coastal habitats. Can tidal pools be a good thing for local ecosystems, or do you think they might damage them further?
No, I think that they're a good thing. If I'm absolutely brutally honest with you, no one wants to pour a load of concrete into a beach. That does set alarm bells ringing. However, a couple of the sites we've been looking at for new tidal pools, one was on the south coast of England, one was on the Isle of Wight. Both are very urbanised beaches in the sense that we have destroyed most of the ecosystem by building there, by tourism. So the justification becomes much more interesting when you talk about the concrete walls which are forming the pool have a sort of bioengineered surface to them. So we're working on a project on the Isle of Wight in Sandown Bay for a new tidal pool with a community group there. And from the beginning, I've been talking about this being more than just a place to swim. They actually, the charity is based around getting people access to water. So those people who are scared of going into or timid about going into the sea, they help them do that. So the tidal pool for them will give them access to the water despite the tide at all times. But I've argued with them that what we need to be doing here is providing more than just a place to swim, that it can become some sort of laboratory or ecosystem on the beach so that we get kids, we get university students, we get people from the local area who perhaps don't swim, but coming down there to have a look in the pool to see what the ecosystem is doing. So we're working with a company called Art Ecology, who are very similar to Living Seawalls. And this will actually enhance the ecosystem on the beach or restore the ecosystem on the beach, which for us is really, really exciting.
And it's interesting, you talk obviously about using concrete, and there's a lot of discussion about materials, particularly in terms of construction of housing and office blocks, and a lot of debate about using both stone and wood. Are either of these a possibility, do you think?
They're definitely a possibility. I think cost will come into it. I would love to do a tidal pool from granite blocks.
Yes.
I did propose that to Plymouth City Council not so long ago, that a restoration of the Devil's Point tidal pool should be done in granite. And they sort of bought into it, but the cost difference is a lot.
Sure.
But that would be my preferred solution.
What about wood? Is that a possibility with a lining?
Funny enough, there was one built using timber up in Powfoot in Scotland back in the 1800s. They built an oval one using railway sleepers locked together. So it is possible. The issues with timber in water is obviously it rots, so you choose a timber which has less or more resilience to the water, such as used with the groins, but then you do get the risk of splinters coming off timbers, especially when you're actually climbing up and over these things. So the benefit of the timber is, of course, working with Articology, who taught us about this, that you can make that very easily into a bioreceptive surface. In other words, burrow holes into it and creatures take to it. So again, the one on the Isle of Wight will probably look at putting timber posts around the inside to increase that use of the surface for benefiting the ecosystems within the pool.
Is there an equivalent? I mean, in Paris, there used to be a wooden floating
yes.
swimming pool.
Yeah.
I mean, is there an equivalent where effectively you're creating a ship-type structure?
The closest I'm thinking of is Thames Baths.
Well, let's talk about that, because now Thames Baths is, in a sense, what, as you said, launched you onto this very interesting focus on your career. And it was a proposal for creating a pool just outside,
multiple locations, yeah.
But the first one was just near the Unilever House, City of London School, Blackfriars location. Describe what the proposal was.
Yes, that vision is still ingrained in my head. So the concept there was, strangely enough, to have a tidal pool, which this is before I realised I was obsessed by these things, so that the tide, which is 6 metre tidal range at Blackfriars Bridge, so you could refill this pool twice daily. And then alongside the tidal pool would be a floating pool going up and down with the tide, both of which would be screened from the main navigation channel, so you have some sort of protection. And then there would be the introduction of native planting as well. And with Jonathan Cook, landscape architects, we did a series of studies about the type of planting which could be put there. And it wasn't until I started that conversation that I realised that actually the river did used to have planting all along it. And it's only since we built out the embankments, built the bridges, that the water flow increased sufficiently to just wipe away anything which grew there. So it began a really interesting conversation about using planting as a indicator of the health of the river, because people immediately assume, because nothing's growing anywhere near it, that it's poisonous. And in fact, that is not the case at all. So that was the essence of the concept. And it was very much a concept. It had Amazonian sort of waterfalls coming off the tidal pool, had smaller sheltered pools. It got a lot of attention. It sent the Port of London Authority into the stratosphere. They were terrified of it, and to a certain extent still are. They don't see why you should be swimming in the river when you could swim in a leisure centre on the land. That is another long conversation. But I keep returning to this idea that before the Bath and Wash Houses Act of 1846, the only place to swim was in places like the river, or indeed the Serpentine. And that is where people learned to swim. So we've lost that whole art of being able to swim in what is a dangerous waterway, because it moves very fast.
Just to pin you down on this, I mean, obviously it's potentially dangerous because of the speed of the water and the change of heights as the tide changes. How would people be protected from shipping?
So the iterations we've been through on the design in conversation with the Port of London Authority have led us to a sort of vessel type approach. So it is very similar to the pontoons you see for the clippers. So it has a freeboard, as in a height off the water of 1.2 metres, which would have to be steel, so that any impact is taken out by that surface area. So there's no chance of a boat entering the pool. And effectively, you're designing a boat full of water. So, and you're counteracting that physics of, obviously, it would sink. So you've got a lot of buoyancy in there, and changing rooms and cafes and restaurants. But it's been a battle. It's been 10 years of numerous sites coming up, numerous
cohorts. How many sites have you looked at since Black Friday's one?
We've probably looked at about 12 to 15 different sites.
Yeah.
With different developers, different councils, conversations with the Tate. We've been out as far west as Kingston, far east as Barking Riverside. We've got very close at Barking Riverside. Unfortunately, I think COVID probably killed that one off. I think it will happen, and I hope I'm the one to see it, or I still hope I'm still around to see it. But it's a lot easier outside the tidal Thames, so the other side of Teddington, or in the docks. And the UK is blessed with lots of docks, a lot of which are redundant.
It's really interesting, because just last year I swam in Canary Wharf.
Mm.
I mean, there's the Royal Victoria Docks, which I think are quite established for swimming in East London. But Canary Wharf opened, I think, for the first time. And there is something quite exciting about swimming at the foot of a tower block. I found it very exciting. Let me ask you about attitudes, changing attitudes to open water swimming generally, because clearly if no one wants to do it, you will not be commissioned to build it. But what have you observed over the past, say, 20, 25 years in terms of a growing interest in this subject?
Phenomenal interest. It astounds me. I mean, I remember when I started on this journey in 2013, and I remember reading about the membership figures for the Outdoor Swimming Society and what they'd done over the preceding 10 years, gone from something like 3,000 up to 30,000, and now they were into the hundreds of thousands of members. It's quite astounding. I mean, you only have to go down to the Serpentine to see how big the movement is and the people who are swimming there. Unfortunately, you and I, Paul, are some of the older people now swimming there. There are youngsters coming through, and they're there all year round. You can go down there on a Monday morning when there's still frost on the ground, and you've got 25, 30 people getting into that lake. I think the health benefits of it are definitely coming through. People are realizing that it makes them feel good. As a very simple example, I didn't go for about 2 weeks for various reasons, and then I went 4 or 5 days ago. It was cold, and I just felt amazing for the rest of the day. It's a very natural high that you get from having your circulation boosted and swimming with the ducks.
One thing that's particularly interesting, if we just focus on the Serpentine, because it's located in the middle of a fabulous park, it's got astonishing tree cover. So you can get there, say, at 6 in the morning, the sun is rising. So even before you get in, it is spectacular. What do you think is the particular quality of basically bringing together swimming and a beautifully designed landscape like Hyde Park?
For me, what is magical about the Serpentine compared to, for example, Hampstead Ponds is the big sky. Yes, it's a larger body of water than Hampstead, so you can get further out into the middle of it. But during the summer months, when it's a little bit warmer and you can hang around a bit more, I'm often found floating on my back just looking at the sky. And somehow that escape from the terraced houses we all live in, the windowless offices we sometimes have to occupy, suddenly just to be able to, first thing in the morning, to lie on your back and stare at the sky, it doesn't matter what it is, if it's cloudy, blue sky, whatever, and just get that silence, that stillness, and that sense of space. For me, that's what brings a lot of the magic.
I've just remembered, and this certainly isn't a tidal swimming pool, but about 10 years ago, the Landscape Institute with the Garden Museum ran an ideas competition called the High Line for London. And one of the, not the winner, but I think number two, was the idea of turning the Regent's Canal into an 8-kilometer-long swimming pool. Yeah. The big issue was what you did with your underpants and your wet swimming trunks. But it's interesting because, you know, not everyone lives or indeed works near the Serpentine. A huge number of people across the country do in fact live or work near a canal. Could you envisage more use being made of canals as places for swimming, or are they too dirty and too shallow?
I don't necessarily have a problem with getting into dirty water. I mean, the Serpentine is far from the mountain spring.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But I think it's the static nature of the canal which scares me somewhat. I wasn't convinced that was a workable solution simply because there is no scope for additional transport on there. I think, you know, meeting a barge coming down a canal.
Yes, while you've got to displace the river traffic.
So you're moving the whole of that. And I think the beauty of all these pools, whether they're tidal pools, whether they're lidos, is that there are multiple things going on, whether it's scuba diver training, whether it's, you know, mums and babies, whether it's, you know, old men like us swimming there. But this is the mix is really, really important.
Let's talk about the economics, because there was a period when many of the lidos which had been built in the 1930s were closed down. And I can think of two or three in walking distance of where we are recording this podcast that have just disappeared. On the other hand, there were a number which have clearly had a major revival, but mainly through the efforts of volunteers and charitable support. If you were to see a new Lido as a completely commercial development or one tied in with a larger landscape and other built environment project, what kind of thinking would a developer need to be persuaded to have, to put it that way?
I think you need a good footfall. So I'd want housing and commercial space tight up against it. I'd want it to be programmed within the community extensively, so it isn't left as open swimming as you so often see in these LIDOs. It needs to be heavily programmed. I think, you know, good examples which have opened up recently, Cleveland Pool has reopened in Bath, which, you know, is right in a community, and a lot of that community weren't so keen about it, but I think they'll come around to it. Sea Lanes in Brighton is another good one, and that's a very interesting model because it's not quite a LIDO. It's a new sort of hybrid model, but they've built a sort of aquatic community around them, so you can book your swimming holiday from there, you can buy a new wetsuit, you can get some physiotherapy, you can learn how to swim in the swim tanks, or you can swim in the sea, and if it's too rough, you can get in their pool. So I really like that clever way of thinking.
So there's got to be a multiplicity of activities.
Absolutely, yeah.
And also presumably a multiplicity of audiences, because if you're only catering for extremely good athletic swimmers, that's a relatively small market.
It is. Yeah, no, absolutely. I think, but that's in a way where the programming comes in, that you make sure that it's accessible. So a lot of the work we've been doing with Future LIDOs is about what other things do we need to add to this. So splash pads for the kids. If you keep kids playing where they want to play, which frankly is in amongst the splash pad, playing with the jets and whatever, then you free up space in the pool for more swimmers. So little things like that. And the Australians do that very well in recent pools which have opened in Sydney. There are some exceptional examples there of how to get that balance right.
The UK coastline does have a number of tidal pools. And near London, we've got Walpole Bay in Margate and Mousel Rock Pool in Cornwall. These are historic sites. Why do you think there are no new tidal pools under construction at the moment?
Well, I think there was a new tidal pool built recently at Southend.
Ah.
And unfortunately, my understanding of it, I'm trying to be diplomatic here, but I think the council may have built it too high up the beach so that not every tide refreshes the pool. So when I went to go and have a look at it in October, so it should still have been vaguely accessible. It was very badly smelling, full of rotten seaweed, and definitely not somewhere you'd want to swim. So I think one has been built. I don't think it was very successful. So we're behind in the UK, and hopefully our project on the Isle of Wight will change that. In Norway, they built one in 2015, and that was part of a coastal development driven by developers. It was on a very inaccessible piece of coastline, as in very rocky. So that was a beautiful solution to making sure that the community can benefit from the coastline. But again, as we've said before, I think the access to docks and rivers across the country are critical to this. And although they wouldn't necessarily be tidal pools, I think inland areas, those are critical to getting people into water.
I want to turn, well, literally to the water's edge, because clearly you could define a pool by the extent of the rock or the concrete. But equally, there are many projects now which are greening the edges of bodies of water. I mean, if you go to Canary Wharf, there's a lot of publicity on the hoardings for a project to green the whole heart of Canary Wharf, and in a way to soften the edges of what was an industrial setting. On the other hand, you've clearly got to contain that water, and you've also got to create a space where people can enter the water safely and indeed get out of the water safely. What are your thoughts on, in a sense, landscaping the edge?
I love exactly how you describe it. I love that blurred edge where swimmers can get in, but also people who don't want to get in. I think it's so important that water is accessible in the sense of touchable by people who don't like to get into water. So I love the water's edge where you can sit and where you can paddle, where you can stick your hand in if you want. That stems really from right at the beginning, again, back to Thames Baths, where I could never understand why the whole of central London is up above the river because of these bloody embankments we've built. Mm. The distance between you and the water is just a major barrier, which is why the excitement of getting down onto the South Bank, onto that sandy beach is so important. And yet the authorities, you know, sort of make it very clear that it's your own risk. But the joy you see down on that waterfront is so important. And that isn't people swimming. That's just people enjoying being down up close to the water. So whatever kind of landscaping can be done to get people closer to the water, to be able to reach it, is so important. And that also communicates messages of cleanliness as well. You know, when you're up above it, you only question why you're up there, and you assume it's because it's a poisonous waterway. Whereas if you're down there and you're splashing in it, it changes perceptions.
Let me ask you, as we get to the close of this discussion, about the responsibility for built environment practitioners to create healthy places, or places where you can become healthy. What's your role in that, do you think?
Well, if I can get some of these Lidos built, I feel that I will have done my bit. I think architects and landscape architects as well have a real responsibility to keep us active in the city, keep us in fresh air, clean, green environments. Green and blue environments have been proven over and over again to be positive to citizens, to city dwellers and beyond. And physical health and well-being, particularly post-pandemic, is critical. And swimming has proven to be so important to getting us all healthy. And so much of this has all been done before. So it's not something new, this. You know, in the 1930s, this was all happening. And so we're learning from that, but we need to action it. And one of the things about Future Lidos is we're going to myth bust all of this. We're going to show that it's a very big growth sector. It can tackle the real issues. We haven't talked about the energy crisis, the cost of building, and all of that. So tidal pools, outdoor pools are much cheaper than building leisure centres. And so we just need to embrace this. We need to provide more swim sites.
Would you say that a tidal pool is almost the equivalent in its value to the early thinking about the role of the park?
Yeah, I think that's a really lovely way of looking at it. Absolutely, yeah. And I think you see that to a certain degree in the sense of the introduction of water increasingly in green environments in cities. It would be lovely to go that little bit further. Beckenham Place in South London, of course, is a parkland setting, and then they introduced the swimming lake there. Not without its complications, but it's established now. And who would have thought of that happening? You know, 10 years, 10, 15 years ago, you probably wouldn't have thought that could be done. But the point is, it is managing risk. It's embracing the risk aspect and overcoming that.
Great. Chris, thank you very much indeed. Now, if you have been inspired by Chris's vision, do have a look at his book, Sea Pools, which was published just towards the end of last year. And if you would like to read his article, together with a wealth of articles that address suds in the city and indeed the legacy of Bazalgette that we have talked about quite a lot, Landscape, the latest edition, is available to download free of charge from the Landscape Institute website. Thank you.